First met her when Wesley got us all together back in the early 80s. And since that time, I've just grown to love this woman beyond description. She's been a mentor. She's been a teacher. She's been a companion and a wonderful lady in my life. And I have enjoyed and I look forward to the times that we have a chance to get together. I love listening to her. She talks funny. I just love all that about her. She's a wonderful lady, and for the last couple of sessions here in Pompano, she hasn't been able to make it for one reason or another. And you should hear the moans and the groans when we have to announce that Willie won't be here. But this year, we're so privileged to have her with us once again, and it gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce to you, from Spring, Texas, Willie B.
Ooh. Good morning. My name is Willie, and I am an alcoholic. It is so good to be here this morning. I hated missing last year. But when you have your hand in a cast from your fingertips clear up to your elbows, it's sort of hard to button your buttons and get everything zipped up. So I couldn't make it, but I missed all of you that have been here year after year and that I've met in other places. Y'all way back there in the back, can you hear me? Good. Okay. I'll get wound up here in a minute. Yeah, that's better. Not too close. I haven't found it absolutely spit and fit and necessary to take a drink of alcohol since June the 19th, 1957. And I know... Thank you. If the new people are wondering why there's applause and why we even say that, how long we've been sober, it's Alcoholics Anonymous' track record. Down in Texas, we sort of emphasize this because we're telling the new people that Alcoholics Anonymous works year after year after year. It's the only track record we have. We don't have any statistics coming out of New York. This many people came into Alcoholics Anonymous. This many people didn't make it. We don't have anything like that. All we have is each other and letting the new people know that it works in your life year after year. In 1983, when we started this, this is our heart here. We've done these all over the world, all over the country. But this is our heart because we started here in 1983. This is our 41st seminar together, John and Charlie and Joe and myself. And it's been a beautiful experience. My job up here is to do the little 12 and 12. And I stay out of the big book, and Charlie and Joe have orders to stay out of my 12 and 12. Because this little book is important too. Not only to each and every one of us as alcoholics, but to the people that we're working with. We can use this thing in so many beautiful ways to help that newcomer. Because we have two basic texts in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is our second one. In AA Comes of Age, Bill tells us that on page 219 of AA Comes of Age, he's given us a little synopsis on the 12 and 12. And he said that in this era of the smooth sailing, because the 12 and 12 was written 14 years after the big book. And Bill had begun to get a lot of questions and a lot of letters, a lot of telephone calls from people saying, Bill, could you give us a little bit more on what you say in the big book about step 2, 3, 4? Can you give us just a little bit more? So he put together a book that just has each separate step for us to look at in depth, because he says in the NAA Comes of Age, in this era of smooth sailing, death claimed two more of our old friends, Richardson, Silky. Like Ann and Dr. Bob, these two died happily confident that AA was at last secure and on its way. One more noteworthy event marked this period of quiet: the publication of AA's 12 Steps and 12 Traditions in 1953. This small volume is strictly a textbook. So he's telling us there that it's a supplementary text to our basic one of the big book. Strictly a textbook which explains AA's 24 basic principles and their application in detail and with great care. The response was far greater than expected. About 50,000 volumes are in circulation as of 1957. There's, of course, millions more now. It is the general feeling that the book has deepened the meaning of our 12 steps as they can be applied to the individual's problem of daily living. He wanted to get them down a little bit more where we could use them one day at a time. And that our 12 traditions can now be better understood and used in guiding the life of our whole society. Of course, we can't lengthen the seminar and take in the 12 traditions, but they will be gone over tomorrow night in a beautiful, beautiful way. But my job is just the 12 steps. In our forward on page 15, this thing's bothering me. When it tells us a little bit more about this book, if we're going to study it all weekend, we want to understand the value of it. In the second paragraph, it says, this book deals with the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. It presents an explicit view of the principles by which AA members recover and by which their society functions. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced, and look what it says, as a way of life. Not the steps, but the principles that come out of those steps after we've done them. Practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And I love that sentence. Because, dear God, that's what I wanted. I wanted to be whole again. I was in so many scattered pieces when I came to this program. I was like a jigsaw puzzle that you go to the store and you bring it home and you dump it out on the table, and it's a whole bunch of little pieces there. And on the back of the box, you have a picture. And this is the picture that you want. You want it to be whole so that the picture is there. So you begin to put your pieces together. And you put them together very carefully. And then you have a whole picture. And my life was in so many little pieces. Well, it was so scattered. And Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to put those pieces one by one, not to grab the thing frantically and say, you know, all right, I want a picture instantly. I want it yesterday. But to be patient and take those principles and put them together one by one by one. And then to put them into my life and let them work on a daily basis. That's why he put this little book together for us, so that we could learn a little bit better how to do this. The last paragraph on page 18, it says, it's hoped that this volume will afford all who read it a close-up view of the principles and forces which have made Alcoholics Anonymous what it is. That's why I love this little book. That's why I love it so dearly. None of us are experts in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There are no such things, because, you know, You know what an expert is. Anybody from out of town, you know. I ran across another little example of an expert because we're beginning to get, you know, experts in our field. I ran across another one that I love. It says an expert is one who knows more and more about less and less until he knows absolutely everything about nothing. Now, a lot of y'all from up in those way up where it snows and, you know, all the snow plows and everything, if you don't understand when I say y'all, it's the plural of all y'all. So just sort of bear with us. You know, there's so many. This beautiful step one that begins on page 21. When we're working with new people and when we first, let me see first, how many people, this is their first seminar? Oh, great. Beautiful. Beautiful. I love to see all my old friends here, but I love you new faces too. And I know that there were a whole bunch of you, you know, you younger folks that were sitting back there and saying, good Lord, she's been sober longer than I've been born. That's all right, hon, but don't come up here and tell me that. But in using this little book, we take it, and because so many people come to us, and you may be still pondering with this question, you know, am I one or am I not one? And maybe you've been through various institutions and they've given you list and list and list of questions to decide whether you're alcoholic or not. It's very important. As Joe and Charlie pointed out in the big book last night, this is the only step that has to be taken 100%. And it's important for you to help yourself get to that point. By just plain old common sense reasoning, sometimes we get so deep into things, don't we? God, I love to be complicated. When I first got here, I wanted to be deep. I wanted those men that I was going to meetings with, because I started in this program in 1953. So you know that for 4 years, I had to come to this decision. 4 long, painful years it took me, with all my, what I thought was my brilliance, with my 2 degrees hanging on the wall that I would remind them that I had often. And in 1953, there weren't very many women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would meet one occasionally. I think I met about 3 in a period of those 4 years. Because we weren't swarming in as we are now. And the thing of it is, gals, and I'm the only broad up here, and by George, I'm going to take advantage of it. I love you men because you men loved me sober. But I will be aiming at the women just a little bit, so you men be a little patient now. I've given you an opportunity to use your patience. But there weren't very many women coming and going in those years. And we're getting so many more women now. Millions of women are coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, but we're not holding them. And this we must start doing a little bit better. We see our gals, if you think of your own group, how many we get in, and then we don't see them anymore after a little while. And we're going to talk a little bit about that as we go through these steps. But these men did. They loved me sober in these 4 years. Why they didn't just kill me and tell God I died, I don't know. Because I aggravated the tar out of them. I was so complicated and I wanted to be so deep. I was sort of like, you know, a lion that ran across this bull, and he killed it and ate it, and he was so full. And instead of going on off and taking a nap and enjoying his fullness, he stood up on this cliff and roared as loud as he could. And a hunter came along and shot him. Now, the moral of that story is, if you're full of bull, keep your mouth shut. But I didn't understand that then. My mouth was going, you know, all the time. The yes buts was also a part of my alcoholism. And some of y'all might be having a little trouble along that line, too, the yes buts. But I know you've taken some of these little quizzes about, you know, to determine whether you're alcoholic. We have a man down in Texas, and I'm going to get to the step, y'all. Just hold on. Just hang on. We're going. Man down in Texas, and I know a lot of you have heard tapes and had the pleasure of knowing old Wino Joe down in Tyler, Texas. We've lost Wino, but we really never will lose him because he's in so many of our hearts. And he sort of got sick of all these, you know, the questions get more and more and more complicated. And I saw some the other day that there, it was 6 pages of questions in this institution, in this place, where they, you know, the drunk was supposed to go through. 6 pages of questions. And some of them were 3-part questions, you know. And I thought about the poor old drunk standing there trying to decide, you know, whether he's alcoholic or not with all these complicated questions. So Wino got sort of tired of it, and he made up his own set of questions. And he allowed me to use them, and I've enjoyed them because they remind me to uncomplicate this program. Number one was, have you ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned? Number two, have you ever been arrested while in jail? Number three, have you ever been run over by your own car while driving it? Number four, have you ever waited in line behind parked cars? I hit a nerve, didn't I? Yeah. See, you understand that, don't you? Have you ever been married to the same person twice and not remembered either time? Have you ever been divorced from the same person twice and never remembered either time? Have you ever become spiritually inspired by a mildew stain on the shower curtain? Have you ever careened off of a 50-foot cliff and lived to tell about it? And the last one, called a ex-friend at 3 a.m. in December to ask her just what she meant by that remark on July the 4th. See, I can see that makes sense to y'all. Whereas so many of these, you know, complicated stuff, these are kind of the insane, crazy things that we did. And for every one that I gave you, you can think of 4 or 5 more that you did. Completely crazy, insane things. That other folks that get drunk, they just don't do those things. Because, see, they're not in a blackout. They're usually passed out. Every one of these little steps that I'm going to do this weekend, I want to give you a principle. This list of principles was given to me by a man when he died. He had over 40 years of sobriety. I loved and admired this man. He was from the Akron area. And Paul gave me this list. And he said, now, Willie, this is not an official list. It's not written in stone any place. It's just when I saw the word principle in the 12th step, that said we need to put these principles into all of our affairs and use them in all of our affairs, then I made up my own little list to go by, to give me a guide, not only for myself, but then when I started working with people. So it's not official. It's not stamped by New York or anything like that. But it gives us an idea of, as we do each one of these steps and as we help a newcomer do the steps, we can give them this principle and build on it, because this is the principle that they're going to start. You can add your own if you think of more. But as we go through the steps, notice the idea that comes through each one of them, that what we're supposed to use in our life for the rest of our lives. The principle behind step one is honesty and acceptance, pure acceptance of our higher power's will for us. Just pure honesty. And we begin to get this principle and start using it in our lives as we do this step one. Let's see what it says. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. In that first paragraph, it says, you know, they give us credit for just being human beings. That's what I like about this program. It said, who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one, of course. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. It's truly awful to admit that, glass in hand, we have warped our minds into such an obsession for destructive drinking that only an act of providence can remove it from us. See, that's a human being trait he's telling us about. He's not saying, alcoholics do this. Dr. Silkworth wrote us another beautiful letter in 57, and he put it, it's in the grapevine, and I love to read his explanation of, don't forget that we're human beings first. And we have all the human being traits as our neighbors and everybody else out on the outside. And that it's a human characteristics not to want to admit defeat. You know, we're taught from the time we're young uns, just little old bitty kids. And when we have children, we do the same thing with our young uns. When they're trying to learn something new, let's take, for instance, when they're trying to tie shoelaces for the first time. We watch them, and they get them all in knots and everything, and we go and help them out. But see, we don't say to them, well, you couldn't do it, so that's it. I'll have to tie your shoes for the rest of your life. What do we say to those kids? We say, here, honey, I'll help you straighten it out. Let's try again. Let's try again. When we raise our own kids and we're trying to teach them, you fellows, you know, get your little boy out and try to teach him how to catch a baseball. And he drops it and he has his, you know, hands this far apart, and you show him better and better. And what do you say to him over and over and over? You say, come on, honey, you can do it. Let's try it again. Let's try it again. This is something that we've been taught to do. What if we were a society of people that gave up at the first obstacle in our life? Or that if we give up any time that there's an obstacle in our life, if we say, well, I can't do that, so I won't try it again. It's a human trait to keep on keeping and try to do it every different way that we possibly can. Make an adjustment here. Make an adjustment the other place. To keep trying to do the thing that's causing us problems. So it's not so odd. I try to remember that when I'm working with a new woman, to tell her, honey, don't worry about not just, you know, being so joyous about being an alcoholic and just so glad to be amongst us. Don't worry about that. You're a human being, and that's natural for you to fight it every step of the way. We fight failure. I hope I fight it for the rest of my life, because I do. When I want to do something new and it comes a little harder, and as age approaches, it comes harder and harder and harder. But I'm still one that, by George, the harder it gets, the bigger go I'll give it. Because, not because I'm an alcoholic, but because I'm a human being. Bill reminds us of that here. Who cares to admit complete defeat? That's not easy. But we can look at it in a common sense way and accomplish that thing. That's why we tried. We weren't set apart so much as we seem to think sometime we are, that we tried every conceivable way to drink when we saw other people doing it and it looked so easy. And we would watch them, and we would make adjustments here or there. We'd eat and not eat. Our big book gives us a whole paragraph, and we have ways that we could add 16 more paragraphs if we all put in our little bit of different ways we tried to learn to drink as a normal person, not knowing that our bodies were saying, uh-uh. You have become allergic to it. You are becoming allergic to it. And I don't know why I couldn't understand that in the very beginning. I'm allergic to penicillin. I took it when it was new back in the 40s for the first time, and I broke out in a little old bitty rash. Didn't bother me too much because it got me back on my feet. I took it again a couple of years later, and I broke out all over my body. But it was still new, and they didn't know too much about it. It put me on my feet, and I just itched a lot. But the third time I took it, I quit breathing. It was giving me little warning signs, but I didn't know that. And do you know I haven't had any penicillin since? I won't let a doctor get near me with penicillin. Because it wasn't my mind that rejected the penicillin. It was my body that after I had put it in there, it finally said, I'm not going to take any more of that. My body will not tolerate penicillin. My body will not tolerate alcohol. It's not up here. I can't make up my mind that I feel so terrible or I have a bad infection that I'm going to just go ahead and give penicillin another try. That would be insane. Not because of my head, but because of my body. All right, it goes on down in the back left bottom paragraph. It says, we know that little good can come to any alcoholic who joins AA unless he has first accepted his devastating weakness and all of its consequences. And I have my girls take their pencil and do ring around words. And all is one of the ring around words that I use. Because I mustn't ever forget myself, and I must try to make my new gal understand that drunkenness is the least of it. The pure drunkenness is not all that big a deal. It's what it did to Willie inside. It's what took all those little pieces and scattered them. All of its consequences. Until he so humbles himself, his sobriety, if any, will be precarious. Of real happiness, he will find none at all. There's lots of promises. We talk about the promises in the big book that are all good, beautiful, positive promises. But we have some negative promises in our 12 and 12. And this is one of them. It's just beginning. Until he does this, of real happiness, he will find none at all. Proved beyond doubt by an immense experience, this is one of the facts of AA life. The principles that we shall find no enduring strength until we first admit complete defeat is the main taproot from which our whole society has sprung and flowered. There's the acceptance. Just as I accepted the fact that I was allergic to penicillin, I must accept the fact that my body is allergic to alcohol. When first challenged to admit defeat, none of us most of us revolted. We had approached AA expecting to be taught self-confidence. Then we had been told that so far as alcohol is concerned, self-confidence was no good whatever. In fact, it's a total liability. Our sponsors declared that we were the victims of a mental obsession so subtly. And let's just think about and note each time the word subtly is used. Because alcoholism didn't jump out at us, you know, when we opened a door one time and there it was. At most of us, it was a gradual, very subtle thing. We weren't all that dumb and stupid because we didn't realize what was going on. When I finally, you know, came to that complete surrender, I thought, dear God, I must have been crazy not to be able to see this before. No, it happened so subtly. It didn't take place all of a sudden. So let's just note how many times our book uses subtly. So subtly powerful that no amount of human willpower could break it. There was, they said, no such thing as the personal conquest of this compulsion by the unaided will. Relentlessly deepening our dilemma, our sponsors pointed out our increasing sensitivity to alcohol. An allergy, they called it. The tyrant alcohol wielded a double-edged sword over us. First, we were smitten by an insane urge that condemned us to go on drinking, and then by an allergy of the body that ensured we would ultimately destroy ourselves in the process. Few indeed were those who, so assailed, have ever won out in single-handed combat. It was a statistical fact that alcoholics, another little promise coming up, that alcoholics almost never recovered on their own resources. And this has been true, apparently, ever since man first crushed grapes. A beautiful man told me one time, said, Willie, so many times the personality of the person brings on the alcoholism. But in just as many cases, the alcoholism brings on that personality. And with so many of our women, God, dear God, and I, this is what happens. In my own case, so many of you have heard my complete story tape, and you know that in my own case, in so many of yours, us gals go along a long time. We're protected by our men, and so many times we're protected by society. And we go on so subtly. We weren't allowed, and more so nowadays than back when I was drinking. But a lady just didn't drink too much. That's all there was to it. And I don't take anything away from any man in this room. I don't take, because we share two things in this room all weekend. We share pain and loss of control. And that's it. As Joe and Charlie pointed out in the big book last night, details, all of our details are different. And I don't take anything away from the pain of you men's alcoholism and the loss of control of your lives. But there's nothing so humiliating or shameful, degrading, than being a woman drunk. And I don't think there's a man in this room that'll disagree with that statement. You know, you men can really get away with a whole bunch of stuff. Always have been. You know, you can get all boiled up and you can jump up on the table and pull off your shirt and put a lampshade on your head and dance, and you just funnier than a crutch. But let us women try the same thing. And the one word that'll go all through the room, isn't she pitiful? Dear God, that's a word I don't ever want applied to me again. Because you never see a cartoon about a woman drunk, do you? Very seldom do you hear a story. If the story starts out, there's these two old drunks in this bar. You immediately figure there's two fellas, because it's going to be a funny joke. It's not going to be about two women. We're the mothers. We're the wives. And the hurt and the shame that we feel, we can't get rid of quite as quickly. And you men that are in groups and see that woman walk in there, know that that shame and humiliation won't go away quite as quickly. And we'll be talking about this weekend. If she sits and cries during the first 19 meetings, be patient, because the camaraderie will not be there that there is among you men. Y'all can start swapping stories right away, and everything is, it lightens up for you a lot quicker than it lightens up for us. And that's not being, you know, taking anything away from the pain is the same. It's just a little, comes out in a little bit different way. Bottom paragraph there on page 22, it says, in AA's pioneering times, none but the most desperate cases could swallow and digest this unpalatable truth that they're telling us about this allergy. Even those last gaspers often had difficulty in realizing how hopeless they actually were, but a few did. And when these last laid hold of the AA principles with all the fervor with which the drowning sea's life preservers, they almost invariably got well. That's why the first edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, published when our membership was small, dealt with low bottom cases only. Many less desperate alcoholics tried AA. That's why I must be patient with my girls that they're not desperate, and to be gentle and to be soft with them. They're not at that desperate stage yet, because Bill tells us here that many less desperate alcoholics tried AA but did not succeed because they could not make that decision or admission of hopelessness. And a lot of us have been to that point where we still had husbands, we still had, that was my case, I still had everything, I still had my job, I hadn't lost material things. Where I was coming apart was on the inside. And I wasn't as desperate in 53 as I was in 57. A lot happened in those 4 years. A lot of heartbreak and a lot of shame and a lot of humiliation. So I wasn't all that desperate. I was just in a little deep trouble, but not deep enough. And it says it's with tremendous satisfaction to record that in the following years, this changed. Alcoholics who still had their health, their families, their jobs, and even two cars in the garage began to recognize their alcoholism. As this trend grew, they were joined by young people who were scarcely more than potential alcoholics. Potentials. I was in my 20s. I was healthy. I had a good life. But in those 4 years, I was working in that potential bracket. I hadn't crossed that invisible line of complete allergy any more than I crossed it the first time they gave me that penicillin. I didn't quit breathing the first time. But as those years progressed, that allergy became full blown. And we began to get the younger people, he says. And goodness knows we're getting them young now, aren't we? They were spared that last 10 or 15 years of literal hell that the rest of us had gone through. Since step one requires an admission that our lives have become unmanageable, how could people such as these take these steps? It was obviously necessary to raise the bottom the rest of us had hit to the point where it could hit them. To emphasize to our new people, and if you are new, you don't have to have been in jail. You don't have to have been in hospitals. You don't have to have lost your family. Dear God, listen this weekend to what our program is telling us. That you don't have to go that far. It's your choice. It might could start this weekend. You don't have to go there. By going back in our own drinking histories, we could show that years before we realized it was out of control, that our drinking even then was no mere habit, that it was indeed the beginning of a fatal progression. To the doubters, we could say, perhaps you're not alcoholic after all. When my girls come to me and they fight it and fight it and fight it and say, you know, I'm not convinced, I will go ahead and tell them, hon, maybe you could try a little controlled drinking. The book suggests it. I don't ever give them anything off the top of my head. But I said, you know, but remember, it's controlled drinking that you need to do. Make up your mind that for the next 2 weeks, you're going to have two drinks in the afternoon. No more and no less. Because they've tested themselves and they've seen that they can go. Women, the majority, not all, the majority of women are periodics. And they know that they can go 3 or 4 weeks, a month, 2 months, 6 months without a drink. And so that's been their test. But that's not the real test of an alcoholic, is it? We can go for any length of time. We just lost a man down in Texas. And God bless him, he's as near death as he can get right now. He had 26 years of sobriety. It's not the length of time. My time that I have in this program, the length doesn't make any difference. It's the width and the depth that makes a difference. But the length doesn't. And to suggest to her that maybe she could make up her mind to take a final test to see whether she's alcoholic. If she will, for 2 solid weeks, 3 weeks, whatever you choose, you can judge by the individual you're working with. But if she can go 2 weeks and take 2 drinks, every evening without fail, and never take that third one, never, then she hasn't arrived yet. Because how many of us real alcoholics can do that? Be honest. How many of us could do it? To go in 2 weeks without a drink is a piece of cake. But 2 drinks every afternoon? I don't think so. And it goes on to suggest how we can help these newcomers. The next page on 24, it says, why all this insistence that every AA must hit bottom first? The answer is that few people will sincerely try to practice the AA program unless he has hit bottom. And that doesn't mean, as the preceding page said, that we have to lose all the material things or lose everything. That's not bottom. My bottom came when I realized that I was no longer a person with dignity. I had the idea that I was a lady that occasionally got drunk. And then I realized that I was a drunk that occasionally was a lady. And I had to get to that and realize how many pieces I was scattered in before I could give up. I still had that beautiful man of mine. I still had all the material things in life. But unless we had hit our own bottom way down deep inside and lost that dignity that we wanted so much. Said, for practicing AA's remaining 11 steps means the adoption of attitudes and actions. Doesn't say anything about how many meetings you go to, how regularly, that's important. But that's not the basis. It says, for practicing the rest of the 11 steps, the adoption of attitudes and actions that almost no alcoholic who is still drinking can dream of taking. Who wishes to be rigorously honest and tolerant? Good Lord. To me, that said boring. You know, honest and tolerant. That sounded so sweet to me. You know, just SERP-type sweet. And I really never had wanted to be a SERP-type sweet person. It just sounded boring. Who wants to confess his faults to another and make restitution for harm done? Who cares anything about a higher power, let alone meditation and prayer? Who wants to sacrifice time and energy in trying to carry AA's message to the next sufferer? No, the average alcoholic, self-centered to the extreme, weren't we so into ourselves? And we were so self-centered. Everything was me, 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 me. And average alcoholic, self-centered in the extreme, doesn't care for this prospect unless he has to do these things in order to stay alive himself. That's why we think sometimes, God, this is a beautiful program. Anyone could take it and use it. And anyone can and make their life better. But see, it doesn't mean quite as much to them as it means to us. Because for us, practicing these principles in all of our affairs can mean life or death for us. And I don't know about you, but I ain't ready to go yet. Under the lash of alcoholism, we are driven to AA. And there we discover the fatal nature of our situation. Then, and only then, do we become as open-minded to conviction and as willing to listen as the dying can be. We stand ready to do anything which will lift the merciless obsession from us. You know, most of us came to AA to get sober. And we stay in AA to get changed. Because that change is what gives us the quality instead of just the quantity. You've seen people sitting around in AA so many times and they've been there a long time. They've been sober year after year after year. And you watch them, a newcomer walks in and they're sitting in their chair that they comfortably get into. And they're sitting there and this newcomer comes in and they'll say, "You're going to love it here. You're going to love this program. It'll make you happy. It'll make you joyous and free." And you know, they look like somebody just hit them in the face with a dead fish. We come to get changed. And sure, we're going to go through some times in life where it's, you know, the smile comes hard. But for that newcomer, we can put on that happy face. We can try to not just say joyous and free, but to emulate it, to make them feel that this is a program that's worth giving a good try to. Admitting we're powerless over alcohol, if we keep the allergy in mind in our doing our step one, if we just keep that solidly in our minds, that this is really what we're accepting, is the fact that our bodies are allergic to it. And that as our bodies become allergic to alcohol, we begin to change. I'd been raised in a little old town in Texas. It's right outside of Houston. It's a little German farming community. And when I say little, I mean little. We didn't even have our own village idiot. We just all took turns. But I was raised there in that little old small town. Kin to everybody. Kissing kin to everybody. My life was so uncomplicated. Honey, if you knew, you're going to meet people that had a lot of tragedy and problems in their very, very young lives. And they've always felt like they had a big empty hole right there. But don't make yourself try to identify with that, because maybe that wasn't your case at all. It wasn't mine. I've always been an outgoing person, living there in that little old town. Of course, I tried in my life later on to convince a psychologist that I had become an alcoholic. He was so anxious for me to find something in my childhood that I finally, you know how we get, If they anxious, we give it to them. So he kept digging in this childhood, and I finally tried to convince him that I became an alcoholic because I had such a boring childhood. Because it really wasn't a swinging town. And as I look back on that childhood, it was happiest and joyous and free. There are no problems in my family. I had the normal pain of growing up. And it was, you know, it's no more painful now than it ever was. There's a little more confusion and a little more junk going on. But just the growing up is painful. Those adolescent years, dear Lord, you look in the mirror and your nose is too big and your ears are too big and, you know, your face is lopsided, and the more you examine, this is sheer pain when you're an adolescent. We'd have one new boy maybe every two or three years come in school. And that very morning that I was just going to get all dressed up, you know, and really impress him, I'd have a zits right on the end of my nose. And you talking trauma. When you're a teenager, that is trauma. Because those are the things that are painful to teenagers. And just that growing up and trying to become that adult, and you're not one yet. You're not a baby anymore. You're not a I have junior high school kids. I'm a teacher by profession, taught 37 years. One time a little lady whispered to another when I said that, "My God, that's why she drank." If I taught teenagers for 37 years. But the thing of it is, I've had low junior high school kids tell me, you know, we're not anybody. And if you have a little adolescent, remember, that's the way he really feels. This one could actually verbalize it. And he said, "We're not anybody. We're not little anymore where people, you know, look after us like they did down in elementary school. We're not big enough to do what the high school kids do. We're just nothings." And that's the way they feel. And see, they're not alcoholics. They're just kids growing up. And try to just, you know, to really talk to your younger people, if you're working with young people, to convince them that a lot of the pain that they're being forced to go back and remember is normal pain of just getting from a little person on through a middle-sized person onto a bigger person and easing into adulthood. So I had all of those little painful problems. But we have to remind ourselves that I had to be honest. I had to remind myself to be honest about my own childhood. And to realize that my bottom didn't have to be complete, absolute tramp routine. That the coming apart on the inside, and that's all this step asks us to do. It is not as complicated as it was when I first approached it. And as I work with other people, I try to get them to see that it's not that complicated. Because in the beginning, as I said before, I wanted to be so deep. And I wanted to be complicated. And at that time, I could complicate a one-car funeral. Because I could take anything and build it up to great proportions. I became a liar. Because when you start making excuse after excuse after excuse, you become a rationalizer and you become a liar. Because if you take those three words, rationalizing, excuse making, and lying, and shake them up in a paper bag, they're going to all fall out together. So by rationalizing my behavior, by keeping making excuses for my behavior, it soon became lies. And if those lies would just stay put in the drunken area, but we learn to lie stone cold sober as protection for ourselves, is to make ourselves feel better. Have you ever walked around with answers to questions you haven't even been asked yet? How about the morning after a blackout? Dear God, I would start answering questions just so if he asked me, I had an answer. I became a liar. I had never had to be a liar. My life was not that complicated. But I became one. You can't be a whole person and live in a morass of lies. You can't run a marriage on lies. You can't raise children on lies. It's no kind of life to have. The principle of honesty that we put into our lives in this step, the more we practice it, the more I practice not making an excuse to you why I haven't done something. Just tell you, I'll try real hard not to let it happen again. I have a step later on that takes care of that. But not to make an excuse to you to make myself feel better. And that's what I had done. I would do it sober. And I had to make myself realize, with the help of a beautiful sponsor, that Willie, it isn't the lies you're telling about your drinking. That's normal. That's okay. When you quit drinking, those lies take care of themselves. But hon, if you catch yourself, you're telling yourself lies every time you make an excuse for unacceptable behavior, for being curt with somebody when you shouldn't have been, for taking your feelings out on them when they didn't deserve it, for taking your feelings out on them when they did deserve it. Cut little by little making those excuses and rationalizing your unacceptable behavior when you're sober. And it will become, after a while, it will become a practice. And you won't make the excuses, you won't rationalize, therefore you won't be a liar anymore. And that was a piece of my puzzle that I could start with. A beautiful piece. I'll see you again this afternoon. Thank you very much.